Leftovers. John C. Nash. Copyright 2021 John C. Nash NASHJC at ncf.ca. 18 Spyglass Ridge, Ottawa, Ontario, K2S1R6, Canada. The cover image is a cropped portion from https://commons.wikimedia.org/wiki/file:Birmingham_blitz_d_for126.jpg, which is in the public domain. Capsule comment. Feasts, famines, wars, parties. They all leave leftovers. Mostly rubbish, of course. But some of the leftovers are people. Damaged, fragile people who miss dying but aren't sure how to go on living. Sometimes, however, leftovers can be made into something special, something better than new. Preamble. Leftovers is a work of fiction. The initial text was written in early 2022. Some people named were real, but except for publicly recorded actions, their role in this story is fictitious. For example, there was a Father Walsh at a Catholic parish in Bitton, not Woolston. A Mr. Clitheroe, much as described, was the headmaster of St. Patrick's School in the early 1950s. There was also a Mr. Newton and a Mrs. Clements whose names I remember. Some descriptions for 1946 have been drawn from childhood recollections that were registered 7 to 10 years later. In some cases, addresses are real, but not the buildings at those addresses, or I have invented a street, such as the 9th Street Northwest in Calgary. I used to live on 9A Street, but at that level there is no 9th. However, if there are historical details about the events on which my fiction is built that make some of the narrative impossible or implausible, I would be delighted to learn about them. I welcome courteous communications, including criticism if the sender is willing to engage in discussion that can bring better understanding. I may be contacted at nashjc@ncf.ca. John Nash, Ottawa, 2022. Part 1. I returned to Southampton on February 7, 1946. Cardington Dispersal Centre tossed me out with my demob clothes in the morning and I arrived late in the afternoon. I'd left the town 2 years before, having been seconded from Supermarine to work on logistics for the RAF. They gave me the rank of flight lieutenant, though I hardly ever was on an aeroplane. Southampton was pretty banged up, though from the train it didn't look any worse than it had 2 years before. Except, of course, I'd nobody to welcome me. My old job at Supermarine was waiting for me. Well, it would be different now that the war was over. Labour was in power, and the Bank of England had just been nationalised not a fortnight previously. My age. I'll be 41 in April. And my job bumped up my demobilisation. Supermarine had written to say they expected me, and I'd replied asking about accommodation. Somehow the fact that the house my wife and I had had in Bitton was now apparently a crater had been forgotten or overlooked. I didn't even know where Agnes, my wife, and Margaret, our 15-year-old daughter, she'd now be 17, were buried. I'd been in Normandy when one of the only two V1s to hit Southampton destroyed my house. And my life. The last letter from Supermarine reached me 10 days ago. It told me that they had arranged for me to board with a Mrs. Crichton in Woolston. Well, that would mean I could walk to work. I used to cycle from Bitton. Not a great distance, though the climb up Upper Deacon Road took a bit of effort. Or a dismount and push. I was somewhat familiar with Woolston, but Radstock Road was not a place I knew. However, the letter from Miss Helen Shoreham of Supermarine said it was not far from Sholing Railway Station, and that is where I disembarked from the local train I'd picked up at Southampton Central. I found the house at the address in the letter. In the fading daylight, I could see the bay window in the front was blocked with a mixture of bits and pieces of wood and corrugated iron. The upstairs window had one pane glass and the other wood or something approximating wood. Bomb damage, probably from whatever hit where there was a crater across and down the road. I knocked on the door, using the heavy knocker in the middle of the door. After a few seconds I heard footsteps, the turning of the Yale lock, and the door opened. "Hello, Mrs. Crichton?" The woman who had opened the door nodded. I continued, "I'm Edward Newman. I believe you are expecting me." "Yes. Come in, please." There was a narrow hallway and a staircase. A very dim light bulb tried to prevent serious accidents. The light was so poor, I could not make out Mrs. Crichton's features. "You'd better follow me upstairs to your room, then we can sort out arrangements," she said, turning and mounting the stairs, which had an almost threadbare runner. The stairs took a turn to the left at the top, and I heard the click of a light switch and a weak beam came from inside a room there. The house had two bedrooms up here, it seemed, with a toilet and bathroom. "This will be your room. I'm afraid it isn't very welcoming. It was my daughter's room, but I couldn't bear to see her things after." "Well, that's really not your concern." "I'm sorry. I understand losing a child." "Well, yes. Most of us have lost someone. It's still difficult, isn't it?" "Yes. The emptiness is always there." For some seconds we both just stood in the room awkwardly. "Well, I'd better let you get sorted. Come down when you're ready, and we'll discuss things. I assume you brought your ration book. I'll need that so I can try to put some food on the table." "I'll come down in a few minutes. Just want to use the lavatory." Mrs. Crichton stepped by me without comment and went down the stairs. I'd have to be careful in the night. The stairway was opposite my door. The toilet door was adjacent and the bathroom door at right angles to that in the stub hallway. To the right was another door. No doubt Mrs. Crichton's room. There was a single bed, a small table with a simple chair, and a frame hanger with a couple of wire coat hangers on it. No wardrobe or anything with drawers. Well, I'd find or make something. Light to read would be a problem. I looked but did not see an outlet. I'd have to see about getting a stronger bulb or an extension I could plug into the light socket. Or else a candle. At least in winter. There was a window to the rear of the house, and I noticed the curtains move a bit as I heard some wind outside. Well, it was a place to put my head. There was a fireplace on the common wall with the other room. No doubt it had one too. That had cardboard in the opening. It would be cold in here, but fuel was scarce. I noticed the bed had a quite decent eiderdown, for which I no doubt would be thankful. I used the toilet, then washed my hands and face. I opened the top of my kit bag. It wasn't all that full. And pulled out a shirt and cuffs and collars. There was a tobacco tin for my collar studs. Better not lose them. I took out the ditty bag with my other shoes and put them under the bed. My suitcase had underwear and pajamas. I set it on the floor next to the table and opened the top. Not a lot of stuff for 4 decades of life. Part 2. I went downstairs and was confronted with two doors. Guessing correctly that the rear one was where I would find Mrs. Crichton, I knocked and went in. The room was a reasonably large kitchen and general-purpose room. A boiler was in the position directly under the fireplace in my room, and it was clearly in use, giving the room a much more cozy feeling than the rest of the house. There were two modest wingback chairs in the corner beyond the boiler, rather ill-fitted in the corner but obviously there between the boiler and the stove for comfort. The gas stove was nearer the other corner, with a counter beside it across the rear wall with a sink under the window. A table and two chairs were just inside the door on the wall nearest the door to the right, with a wireless on the table. The curtained window obviously looked out to the rear, with a door to its right that was bolted top and bottom. "Would you like a cup of tea, Mr. Newman?" "Yes, please. With milk if you have it, but I gave up sugar in 41. "Didn't we all?" was the rather resigned comment in reply. But the tea was steeping on the table. "Thank you," I said as Mrs. Crichton handed me my cup. "Shall we try to work out the details of my room and board?" "Yes, I suppose we'd better. It's all new to me." "Do I take it that you had this house with your family?" "Yes. It's a council house that I had with my husband and daughter." "Both lost in the war?" "Jeremy was on HMS Hood. Jenny and I were here, and we survived the blitzing we got. But you're with Supermarine, so you probably know about that." "I was here until late 1943 when the RAF took me to manage aircraft parts and logistics. That was what I did. Maybe we'll still do. For Supermarine. We had a house in Bitton. AV1 got it in July, 44. My wife Agnes and daughter Margaret, who we called Peggy, were both there. I've still to find out where they're buried and what, if anything, I can recover of the house or land. We were fortunate enough to own it." "It seems you and I are a pair. An unmatched pair of leftovers," Mrs. Crichton said with a great tiredness. "Jenny was killed in a stupid road accident last May when an American dispatch rider came down the wrong side of the road. Just 2 days before the war ended." The bitterness in her voice was palpable. "You have no other family here?" "I was raised in an orphanage, and Jeremy was a late only child. I've an older brother. 10 years older, in fact. In Calgary in Canada. My parents died just before the war. Agnes' family is up north in Manchester. A sister and her husband. Her parents died during, but not directly of, the war. Your label for us is sadly appropriate." I realized that while in Warmwell waiting to be demobbed, I'd managed to liberate some rich tea biscuits. Now seemed appropriate to share them. I excused myself and went to get the tin in which I had them. At the same time I got my ration book. Coming back down, I put these on the table and sat down, saying, "Here's my ration book. And I managed to acquire these a week ago. Perhaps they'll help to get us off to a good start." "Thank you. It's kind," Mrs. Crichton was crying. I saw now she was somewhere in her late 30s, but looked older with the sadness that seemed to be a miasma around her. She was wearing a cardigan and a tweed skirt, some very heavy lisle stockings and plain shoes. An apron was around her waist. "My apologies. I don't want you to cry." "Sorry. It's my fault. Kindness makes it harder, but I do appreciate the biscuits." She had a handkerchief in the pocket of the apron and dried her eyes. "Now I gather you want room and board. Well, breakfast and tea. Will you get dinner at Supermarine?" "I used to eat dinner at the canteen. Well, before the war I'd cycle home to Bitton and Agnes would have a hot dinner ready. But I think now that the canteen will be better, and I believe it doesn't chew into the rations. You may have to give them some points. I don't know. I worked in a small engineering shop making pieces for Thornycrofts until a few weeks ago, when the men started to come back. Now I've just Jeremy's pension, the miserable pound a week and taxed at 50% because they say it's unearned, and the council said one person in this house wasn't right and wanted me out. A neighbor said I should get a lodger, so here we are." "We're both novices then," I said. As far as I can tell, I should charge something like £1 a week for rent and the two meals. But they said that baths and laundry and heat would be extra. I knew I'd be earning over £15 a week. That was my wage before I left, and there was no reason to suspect less. I said I like a bath, and I know I'm going to want to put a better light in my room so I can read. And I hate fuss about this and that and the other thing. Would it be easier to say 30 shillings all in? And if you keep a good record of your expenses, you can let me know if you are out of pocket. Also, if you think of some treat that will cost a bit more, I'd rather you asked and we had something nice, that is, if it's available. Mrs. Crichton looked confused. There was a fairly long silence, then she said that would be very nice. Though I'll be so embarrassed to ask. Have you got an old jam jar or teacup without a handle? I think so. Was going to throw it out, but thought it might be useful. She rummaged under the sink and brought out a floral pattern cup with the handle broken off. Put it on the shelf there, and I'll suggest we each put in a shilling a week for treats, but you'll be in charge of spending it. Mrs. Crichton looked at me quizzically, then said, "All right. We'll give it a try for a month and see how we get on." I took out my wallet and took out a pound note and a 10-shilling note and gave them to her. I said, "When you get a chance, get a small notebook and we'll use it as the rent book. It can live here on the table if you like." I should have already thought of that. "When do you prefer we have meals?" I asked. "I presume that you want your breakfast in time to get to the factory by 8:15, she replied. I nodded. She continued, "I've no great preference for time for tea. Jeremy just had a cup of tea when he came in from work. That was before he joined the Navy in 1935. Then we'd have a sort of supper at 7 or 7:30. "Would you mind if we did that?" I said. "It would allow me some flexibility at work or else if I want a pint on the way home." "What about if you have someone to meet in the evening?" Mrs. Crichton asked. "Perhaps we can find a slate and some chalk and set it here on the table so we can leave a message for each other if we've no chance to arrange things. Truthfully, I'm new to this. I went from home life to the RAF, and the latter has been a series of changes. I've not been in one place for longer than 3 weeks in more than 2 years. What about tonight? I've a couple of sausages each and some potatoes and cabbage. They'll take me the better part of an hour unless I rush." "No need to rush. It's about 5 now. Why don't we plan for 7? I'd like to take a walk and familiarize myself with the neighborhood." "Oh. Will I have a key, or will you be here?" I should have remembered. "It's here by the clock. I'm sorry to be so disorganized, Mr. Newman. You seem a nice man, and I appreciate your patience with me." As I put the key on my keychain, I said, "Let's hope we get along well, Mrs. Crichton. Why don't you put my biscuit tin somewhere obvious and we'll fill it when we can from the teacup money?" In putting the key on the keychain, I realized that there were two keys on it that likely were no use at all. One was for my house, now gone. The other was for a small metal box that had some mementos in it. Likely also gone. "Yes. I'll do that. Thank you. Rich tea, by the way, are a particular favorite of mine. I've not had one since. Well, a long time." Part 3. My raincoat. My only coat now that I'd had to hand in my greatcoat on demobilization. Was upstairs. As I exited the kitchen, which is what I came to always call it, I noticed some hooks on the wall of the hallway, as well as an umbrella stand. I used to have an umbrella. Used to. I got my coat, hat and scarf, and made sure my gloves were in the pocket. Touching my pocket to ensure I had my key, I left the house and turned down towards the Itchen. I might as well figure out my route for tomorrow, and hopefully find a pub for a drink. The air was misty and the few street lights still working made cones of dim light. My footsteps rang strangely in the darkness. I got to Manor Road and turned left. After 100 yards or so, the skeleton of St. Patrick's Church loomed out of the night. I walked round the corner to the left and found the front of the church. It had been gutted by an incendiary bomb early in the war. I expected, and found, a notice saying that masses were in the school next door. There was one at 9 in the morning on Sundays. Agnes had been a Catholic. I wasn't. Now I found less reason to believe than before, but I thought it might be helpful to at least sit in a pew of a Sunday morning. It would pass an empty time. And possibly someone in the church would know where Agnes and Margaret had been placed. I turned round and headed toward the chain bridge. The Itchen works were just to the right of the ferry that pulled itself across the river on chains. I could get here in less than 10 minutes in a hurry or 15 at a gentler walk from Radstock Road. Having satisfied myself of this, I walked casually back to the church. Well, to the Cricketer's Arms, which was opposite. I went into the smoky bar and ordered a pint of bitter, then found a seat near a corner. I'd just taken a good swig of my drink when a voice on my left said, "Ted." "Ted Newman. Heard you were coming back." I turned and responded, "Charlie. It's good to see a familiar face. I just got demobbed today." "Sorry to hear about Agnes and your daughter, Ted. And the house too, of course, but that's just bricks and mortar." "Thanks, Charlie. It'll take me a while to get used to, I'm afraid. And the last couple of years have been so frantic that I've not had time to think about things much. I'm going to have to watch myself." "Where are you staying?" Charlie asked. He was about 60 and had been one of the army of quietly competent people who got things done for me, finding sources of materials or services or places or transport when nobody else could. "I'm lodging with a Mrs. Crichton at 161 Radstock Road." "Ah. Then we'll see you here, I think. Probably not too nice lodging. I'll grab the money and feed you rubbish." "Perhaps." She's new to the role of landlady. Lost her husband on the hood and her daughter to a road accident. "Oh. I heard about that. Stupid American dispatch rider on a motorbike. The girl was riding her bicycle to bring home the shopping and he went to the right-hand side and straight into her. Right before VE Day." "Yes," Mrs. Crichton said. "Well, if she's new to being landlady, she may be all right. If not, let me know and we'll see what can be arranged, but things are pretty awkward now for accommodation. You could say Jerry did a lot of slum clearance. Mind you, he got a lot of the good stuff too." We chatted a bit about different people we knew and what might be going on at the works. I'd find out more in the morning. Looking at my watch, I saw it was 6:30, so I excused myself and walked back to my digs. Part 4. Supper wasn't much to write home about. But then I didn't have a home to write to. Still, from what I read in the papers, there was precious little available. In the forces we did all right, but in the winter of 42-43 I remember Agnes crying because she couldn't feed us a decent meal. And apparently now there was even less available than during the war. I was determined not to complain. Mrs. Crichton had had enough misery. There was a rice pudding. Not terribly sweet, but all right. I made sure to express my gratitude. "Mr. Newman. I'm not sure how it might work, but I'm willing to suggest that if you want to read or listen to the wireless of an evening, you could do so here in the kitchen. It'll be cold upstairs. I can't afford much coal, besides it being rationed, and those upstairs fireplaces simply send the heat up into the sky, so we blocked them off. That would be much appreciated, Mrs. Crichton. I'll try to keep out from underfoot. By the way, I'm quite good with my hands. If there's anything needs fixing, I'll be happy to give it a try. There probably are. Perhaps on Saturday morning I can show you where I keep Jeremy's tools. Somehow I still think of them as his. Of course. Who was I to destroy a way of remembering? I needed to find some of my own. I had a couple of newspapers and read them for the next hour. Mrs. Crichton, without asking, made another pot of tea and poured me one, then turned on the wireless as the BBC 9 o'clock news was soon to start. After Alva Little finished, I said, "Can you use old newspaper?" "Yes. I keep some in the box there beside the coal scuttle. Just put papers there when you're done with them. If there's more than I need, I'll find a use for them. Don't worry. It's been a long day for me, so I'll turn in. Is porridge all right for breakfast? We only get an egg every fortnight or so, and I'm not much of a fan of the powdered kind." "That'll be fine. Thank you, Mrs. Crichton." "Oh, I should tell you that I leave the hot water upstairs off except when it's bath night, so do let me know. And there's a jug here for you to use for shaving water." "Thank you, Mrs. Crichton." "Can I ask which night you'd prefer for baths?" "Oh, I'd not thought. On my own, I just pull the curtains and wash here in the kitchen. Doesn't seem worth going to the fuss of turning on the tap and stoking the fire up. What would you prefer?" "Shall we aim for Sunday night and see how that works?" "All right. That suits me too. I hope the tap isn't seized." "We'll sort it out. Good night, Mrs. Crichton." Part 5. The next morning, I was up at 6:30 so I could be sure I was presentable. I didn't have much in the way of clothing except my demob suit. I'd got a few coupons for the points with my release, but not nearly enough for much clothing. I'd have to look for second hand. Probably dead men's clothing. Maybe Mr. Crichton was about my size. A delicate conversation, but perhaps asking where to get second-hand clothing might elicit a response. The porridge was, unfortunately, unadorned. I'll have to find a way to liven it up. Sugar was not likely to be available. Possibly some of the Nestle's condensed milk. It needed points, or else a big premium on the black market. We'd see. Maybe some jam. Similar issues. I got to Supermarine at 8:00 and waited in Mr. Gooch's anteroom. Miss Shoreham came in at 8:05 and we introduced ourselves. She was a tidy, plain woman of perhaps 35. All business but not unfriendly. "I hope the lodgings are satisfactory, Mr. Newman." "I think they'll do fine. Well, at least as good as I may expect to find given all the damage that's been done around here. Mrs. Crichton is new to being a landlady, and I'm new to being a tenant, so hopefully we will learn together, and cordially." We got no further in this conversation, as Gooch came in. I spent an hour with him learning what he wanted of me. Supermarine was transitioning to post-war production of fewer aircraft, but more advanced types. In particular, we were going to produce a jet version of the Spiteful, which would be called the Attacker. There would be slightly different logistics, even though the engine came from Rolls-Royce. The Neen jet rather than the Griffin piston engine in the Spiteful. I learnt my wage was increased to £19 a week. But there was more income tax than I remembered. However, right now I had no large expenditure in mind. My immediate plan was to find my feet at work and to avoid falling into a pit of despondency outside of work hours. Truthfully, I'd no real idea what I should be doing or what I wanted to do. Perhaps first, I should find out where Agnes and Margaret were buried and if there were anything left of value from the house or the land. Part 6. After my conversation with Mr. Gooch, Miss Shoreham took me in hand and showed me the office from which I would work. It had a telephone, a desk, two chairs, and a filing cabinet. I was present enough to ask what was my telephone number, and Miss Shoreham rattled it off almost too fast for me to write down. Fortunately, I had a pencil and a small notebook. Somewhere in the last 2 years my fountain pen had disappeared. I wonder if one needed points. Perhaps again, second hand. Miss Shoreham also told me there was to be a group meeting at 11 to introduce me to the rest of the logistics group. When that happened, I was pleased to see Charlie present. Not so agreeable was the obvious disappointment of a Mr. James Hall, who had been acting. I'd have to try to find ways to bring him on side, or else move him out. Before Miss Shoreham left, I asked her if she knew where I might find out about the disposition of my house, and she said she would either telephone or leave me a note once she had information. She guessed also that I would want to know about Agnes and Margaret, and said she would attempt to get me information. I told her I also planned to investigate with the church Agnes used to attend. We parted agreeably at just before 9:30. I spent much of the morning apart from the meeting, which did not last very long, looking over various reports for the last few months and familiarizing myself with what was going on. At 1:45, I put on my coat and went to the canteen. It was Friday. Whether the Catholic dictum was in force or not, the best offering available was a vegetable pie. It was reasonably tasty, and it was filling enough. We seemed to be permanently hungry, of course. There was a cabinet pudding with custard. Forgettable, but not so bad as to push aside. At 1:45, I knocked on Mr. Hall's office door. "Is it convenient to have a chat so I can get up to speed?" I asked. "Would you mind if I finish these figures first? It will only take me 1/4 hour. "Yes. It will waste your time to interrupt. Come to my office when you're ready. I'll see if I can get some tea." "Milk?" "Yes, thanks." 20 minutes later, Hall came into my office. I motioned for him to shut the door. "My return is likely to be awkward for both of us," I said. "I was grabbed by the RAF. And Supermarine more or less has to take me back now the RAF has finished with my services. But in the meantime, you've been effectively promoted, and now you are pushed back again. Does that more or less sum things up?" Hall looked nervous, but said it pretty much describes the situation, Mr. Newman. "I'd like to suggest that we make the best of a bad situation, if I may. In your place, I'd feel a good deal of resentment, and I'd be the obvious target, though clearly I'm not the villain here. In fact, nobody really is, except Mr. Hitler. Now we have 2 generals and 1 army, and that is only going to work if one of us takes a subordinate role. Supermarine has said you're going to be the number 2. However, I know I'd not like that after running the show. So my suggestion is that both you and I try to find you a job at least as good as the one I'm being dropped back into. Or else a suitable move for me. With what's happened to me and my family, I'm not insistent on having this job rather than something roughly equal. And in the meantime, we focus on making sure we both do a good job of work here and avoid the temptation to try to one-up each other, because if we fall into that trap, I suspect we'll both end up poorer for it." I stopped and waited to see how Hall would react. "Your directness is appreciated, Mr. Newman. I was available after you left because I had TB a few years ago. I was turned down for the forces. Supermarine got me from Vickers when you left. I guess I'm a decade younger than you, and I'd like to move up. What you've said makes sense, and I agree the temptation is to try to show how much better I am, etc. You'll have my cooperation assuming you mean what you say. I mean it, but no doubt it won't be a piece of cake for either of us, though where a piece of cake is to be found these days is a good question. Hall chuckled. Indeed, Mr. Newman. Now would you like me to bring you up to speed on the current situation? We spent the rest of the afternoon going over different aspects of Supermarine's current activities and making some plans to address likely problems. By 5:15 I was tired. I closed my office. There were now 5 keys on my ring with the filing cabinet and office door. I took with me a note from Miss Shoreham giving the address and phone number of council offices for land use and for births and deaths. Before Hall had left my office, I told him I would be taking time off in the middle of Monday to sort out my bank and matters related to the death of my wife and daughter. He said he would make sure anything that arose was taken care of, which he would have done anyway had I not been there. I did remember to ask if we worked on Saturday now. During the war, we'd worked shifts on Saturday and Sunday. It seemed we were now back to peacetime hours. Part 7. Good evening, Mrs. Crichton, I called as I came in. The kitchen door opened and Mrs. Crichton said, "Good evening, Mr. Newman, I hope you had a good day." It went as well as could be expected, Mrs. Crichton. I hope your day was also productive. I managed the shopping for the weekend. Then I realized we didn't talk about lunch on Saturday and Sunday, and I wondered if you expected me to prepare something for you. For now, why don't we assume I'll look after myself? Oh. I noticed that St. Patrick's has Mass at 9 on Sunday in the school somewhere. Will that be inconvenient for you for breakfast?
No.
No.
Not at all.
I go to Mass myself then. And if I go to communion, I don't eat until after, but you could have some toast. There should be some dripping, but please use it sparingly. I even have some Marmite if you like that. We could see about getting some marmalade if you like that, but it needs points or else substitution in the rations. I was still standing in the hall. Perhaps I should come in the kitchen so we don't let the heat out? I asked. Oh, yes. Silly of me. It's going to take some getting used to. But need not be too unpleasant, I hope. I was going to suggest fish and chips tonight, Mr. Newman. I took your ration book to the grocer, but his delivery won't be in until next Tuesday, so there's a bit of mismatch between supply and demand.
No.
That's fine. Do you want me to go? I suggested. I could use a walk. I've been flapping around in here, I'm afraid, trying to think what I've forgotten. Don't get too panicked. By the way, you mentioned points. I am going to have to learn how many I need to get some suitable clothing. My civvy clothes probably got blown to pieces or else grew some looter's legs. If you find second-hand, you don't need points. Actually, if it wouldn't bother you, I've a couple of bits of Jeremy's that might be serviceable. I'll bring them down after supper. Perhaps, if you don't mind, I'll go now and get the fish and chips. Is there anything you particularly like or don't? Mind you, there's probably just Hobson's choice. It'll be a treat. Haven't had fish and chips for a couple of years. Part 8. After we'd eaten what was most satisfactory. Actually from the newspaper, since I insisted Mrs. Crichton not dirty dishes unnecessarily. We cleared away and washed hands and she went upstairs to get some of her late husband's clothes. She came down with a big armful. There was a suit with 2 pairs of trousers, 3 white shirts, 9 collars, 6 cuffs for the shirt that had removable cuffs, a pullover, a cardigan, and a pair of flannels. We unraveled the socks, I'm afraid, so we could knit other things. Surprisingly, the garments fitted me well enough. They were a half to a full size bigger, but would not need altering. If there are any studs that you have, I'd be glad of those too, Mrs. Crichton. They always seem to manage to get lost. I know. But it's easier to starch collars and cuffs when they're off the shirt. Can I suggest that we find a second-hand shop and use their prices for me to give you a fair amount for these? If you are prepared to sell them, that is. For a long while I wanted to hang on to them. But it's time to let go before the moths eat them up. I'll be very happy with amounts based on prices in the second-hand shops. Part 9. Saturday morning, by arrangement, I had breakfast at the same time as on Friday, then went into the center of Southampton to look in the shops. I particularly wanted to find a suitable fountain pen and to know the prices in money and points of some clothing it means. I probably wouldn't buy today, since I could inconvenience myself greatly if I used up my points then needed them for something particular. I took the chain bridge and walked into town. I could have taken a bus, or even a train, but wanted to see things, and walking was the best way to do that. Still, almost all of the department stores had been blitzed. Many of the shops had set up covered barrows in the streets. Woolworths included. British Home Stores let me learn that I could get some underwear and socks with not many points. Shirts would drain my points allocation very fast. But I did note the prices of the shirts, collars and cuffs. Down some side streets I found some second-hand shops and noted prices there. I'd show my notes to Mrs. Crichton and she could decide what she wanted for Jeremy's clothes. I went in W.H. Smith and looked at pens. There was a Conway Stewart for 17 and 6 that I liked, so I bought it and a bottle of ink, as well as a pair of small notebooks, as I might as well have a rent book right away. It was now about noon, so I found a pub and managed to get a beer and a rather indifferent sandwich with fish paste. Then I took the train to Bitton and walked to where my house used to be. As I approached the crater, which was all that was left, my pace slowed. There was a fence that might prevent the cautious from falling into the crater, but it would not inhibit any reasonable attempt to enter. For some minutes I stood and remembered. Then I heard someone say, "Ted Newman? Is that you?" "Hi, George," I said. It was George Cummings, with whom I'd been an ARP warden. I was demobbed Thursday and started back at Supermarine yesterday. I thought I should come and see the remains. "So sorry about Agnes and Margaret, Ted. I was on duty that day. With a couple of the boys, we gathered what we could of mementos. There wasn't a lot, I'm afraid. And I've got it in an old biscuit box. One of the wholesale ones. You can come and get it now if you'd like." "Yes. Thanks. Sorry, I'm a bit at sixes and sevens. Most people got a leave on returning to England, but there was some fuss about me getting demobbed quickly and that got lost in the shuffle, so I've not been back until now." "Got to be a bit of a shock. Where are you staying?" "With a Mrs. Crichton at 161 Radstock Road in Woolston. She lost her husband on Hood and her daughter less than a year ago to a road accident with an American motorcyclist. The case got some attention. The American soldier hadn't been here more than a couple of days and had been given no instruction on British roads and signs. I'll write down your address. Some of the other boys probably would like to share a pint with you sometime." I knew where George lived and we talked as we walked there, no more than a couple of hundred yards. When we got to George's house, his wife and children were not there. "Gone up the town to see if there's anything worth buying, especially if it doesn't need points," George said, letting us in. Go in the kitchen and we'll have a cuppa. I'll get the box from under the stairs. The box was a 1 foot cube and bigger than I'd expected. George said, I'm afraid the contents were just tossed in. I appreciate the effort. You mustn't forget I was with you when there were similar situations. However, can you tell me anything about where Agnes and Margaret were buried? I probably should have made a better note of that, but the council offices should have a record. Or Beeston's, the undertaker. They did the funeral, not that I was able to be there. George looked a little awkward. I didn't pry but said, Gooch secretary, Miss Shoreham, gave me the address and telephone of the council. I'll follow up on Monday. And tomorrow I'll go to Mass at St. Patrick's and see if I can find out what they may know. Yes, it wouldn't surprise me if they knew. But Ted, I must warn you the V1 was a nasty business. My guess is that your wife and daughter are in the same casket, it pains me to tell you, though I think you'll understand from the times we dealt with such things. Sadly, yes. I'm still trying to deal with these things. Not sure I'll ever escape the ghosts. Yes, Ted. The ghosts haunt us even in the daylight. Part 10. I got back to Radstock Road around 4 o'clock. Mrs. Crichton heard my key in the lock and invited me for a cup of tea. I gave her one of the notebooks and the pages with prices of clothes. Oh. These are much more than I expected. A couple of quid would do. With the suit and trousers, my calculation is closer to 4 times that. How about a fiver? No, that's too much. £4 at most. I had about £25 in my wallet still, having yet to go to my bank that was in the centre of town, if it hadn't been bombed out. I should arrange to see the bank manager and let him know my current address. I had been in touch by letter, but that was some time ago. In any event, I gave Mrs. Crichton £4. I found myself a pen and some ink, as well as that notebook and one other for myself. I should, I suppose, have bought some stationery, but I did have 3 or 4 envelopes and some sheet of letter paper in my suitcase. I had meant to look for a small chest of drawers this morning. Well, I suppose it could wait. I'd only been here a couple of days. And you obviously bought some other things, Mrs. Crichton said. Actually, no. I went to where my house had been and ran into a colleague from the ARP. We were wardens together. He and some others attended when my wife and daughter were killed, and they put what things they could salvage and keep from looters into this wholesale biscuit tin. It was a favor to a friend, but I am most grateful, even though I've yet to take a look. I'm sorry I spoke so quickly. You'll want some privacy to go through the contents. Yes, I think I'll go upstairs and spend some time doing that. I found a stronger light bulb for you. I hope it helps. Thank you, Mrs. Crichton. I'll go up. What time do you want supper? It can be at 7, but if you are happier with a bit earlier, it would mean I don't have to rush to meet Enid, a neighbor I'm going to have a drink with. Would 6:30 be better? Yes, perfect. Thank you, Mr. Newman. Part 11. I had some trepidation in opening the tin. The lid was on tightly, and I had to wrestle it off. Inside was a messy mass of bits and pieces. There were several letters, including one I remembered writing to Agnes from near Cayenne. There were some loose photographs among some silver cutlery, which could be worth something, I supposed. I would have to carefully organize the pictures and put them in an album. There was also the small album that Agnes and I had made of when we married and when Margaret was a baby. It struck me suddenly and forcefully that George had given me back some memories. I felt tears running down my face and found my handkerchief. And there was my tin box. I still had its key and opened it. Inside were my birth certificate and that of Agnes and also of Margaret. Our marriage license. I would need to get death certificates, though there was no insurance depending on their presentation. There were 10 gold sovereigns. Our just-in-case reserve of money. A string of cultured pearls that I'd bought Agnes on our 10th wedding anniversary. My father's pocket watch. He'd been a railway station master at a small station on the London-Portsmouth line. I didn't find my bank book, nor my checkbook, though I'd taken a half dozen blank checks with me and still had those in an oilcloth bag in my suitcase. My pay was to be sent to me in 3 installments as postal money orders. I'd not drawn any for the period from D-Day to D-Mob, having sold my cigarette allowance. And in any event, my pay was supposed to go to Agnes, but after the V1, there was a hiatus. Several visits to the paymaster at Warmwell were needed to sort that out, but I'd be getting over £450 soon. Still, there should be a couple of hundred in my bank account. As I've related above, I had written to the bank to tell them where I was, but that my permanent address was still uncertain. They did have my employer's address at Supermarine, of course. There was a pair of woolen booties. Margaret's first. A couple of her school reports. Oh. Her post office savings book. Maybe I would need a death certificate after all. I opened the small, thin notebook. The final balance was £11.02. I wondered if I'd have trouble recovering that. I didn't need the money, but didn't want it to disappear into some government coffer either. Then there was an envelope with "For Mr. Edward Newman, rings from Mrs. Newman." And a signature I didn't recognize, and the date July 21, 1944. I opened it to see the modest engagement ring. A tiny diamond in a silver mounting, and a thin gold band. There was a card as well. It gave the name of an undertaker's, and the name matched that on the signature. Well, it gave me a way to find out where my family were interred. There were some other items. Indeed, a fountain pen that Agnes used to write with. It was likely too small for my hand, but I'd clean it up and see. Be nice to have one close at hand here as well as the new one I'd acquired. Time was marching on. I'd been rather slow taking things out, and it was 6:25. There were still some odds and ends in the bottom of the box, but I put the rest of the things back in the box and put on the top, then I used the WC and washed my hands and went down to supper. Part 12. The next morning I didn't set my alarm clock, but was awake anyway by 7. It wasn't just beginning to get light out yet this early in February. I put my raincoat over my pajamas and went downstairs and got some water to shave, then came back up and did this, noting my breath steaming as I did so. I should look for a dressing gown. Another item to remember, and hopefully to find without using points. The details of rationing added to the bleakness. Still, we weren't being bombed and strafed anymore. I was returning to my room when I realized I could hear weeping from Mrs. Crichton's room. Should I knock and try to offer comfort? Probably not. Grief was everywhere with the war, and I knew myself that people were genuine in wanting to give comfort, but, just as Mrs. Crichton had cried when I shared the rich tea, their kindness made the pain of loss more acute. I'd had my share of tears against whatever passed for a pillow during the weeks after I learnt about Agnes and Margaret. Learned from a yellow and muddied slip of paper passed down from channels to our transport depot in northern France as we chased the Wehrmacht into Belgium. I dressed and put on my tie. I'd better talk to Mrs. Crichton about laundry, as I was getting low. Indeed, tomorrow I'd beg Monday off to shop for some underwear and socks and go to the council offices and the undertakers to learn what I could. Mrs. Crichton hadn't left her room. I decided to make some tea and some toast. Bread wasn't rationed, thankfully. While in the kitchen, I put a couple of lumps of coal into the boiler. Just enough to keep the fire from dying. When I was making tea, the gas died and I had to put a shilling in the meter. I took one from the teacup for now, as my pockets had no shillings. I say pockets, but coins and keys can make holes, so I use a small leather purse I've had since a teenager. I drank a cup of tea and had two slices of toast lightly spread with dripping and a bit of Marmite. Strange. Hadn't had it since 4 or 5 years ago. As I was finishing, Mrs. Crichton came into the kitchen. Good morning, Mr. Newman.
Oh.
You've made yourself something. Just tea and toast, with a minimum of dripping on it. The pot's still hot if you want a cup.
Oh.
And I took a shilling from the cup for the gas. It ran out while I was boiling the kettle. Thank you, Mr. Newman. I really should have been up and done that. Mrs. Crichton. I really don't want you treating me like a hotel guest. Things can be a lot less stressful if we behave like two people who are sharing accommodations. I doubt either of us are used to the landlady and lodger roles anyway. Yes. You're right, but somehow working things out is awkward. Are you going to church today? I asked. Yes. But I think I'll have some tea and toast and forego Holy Communion. What time should we leave? It's almost 8 now. Shall we leave at 8:30? We'll be a bit early, but I like to look at the notices. They have a temporary board they put up in the back of the classroom we use for mass. That would be fine. I'll go and get a letter I'm writing to my brother in Canada. I want to send it now. I have an address for him to write back to. I returned with my letter, my new pen, which I'd filled with ink, and a varnished thin plywood board that served as a portable writing desk. There were advantages to working in aircraft manufacturing, since plywood was generally unavailable. This was a corner where some sheathing had been shaped and left a scrap that yielded a 12-by-15-inch board I'd sanded and finished. It fit nicely in my suitcase top and provided some substance to the old and rather cheap leather of the case. That's a nice idea, Mrs. Crichton said as I sat in one of the wing chairs and wrote the address for my brother on the envelope. Mr. Joseph Newman. 312 9 Street Northwest. Calgary, Alberta. Canada. I stuck on the 6D stamp I'd bought some weeks earlier in Warmwell. After I got the stamp, I realized a reply, if any, would have to chase after me when I was demobilized. At the time I didn't have a stable address, and somehow didn't want to use Supermarine. Now I did have an address. Last night I'd written Joseph a fairly comprehensive account of the last couple of years on two rather crammed sheets of paper. Weight was critical for air letters. I wrote air mail in big letters on the envelope and put the return address on the back, as well as having written it inside. I hoped we could reconnect. It was almost time to go. I sprinted upstairs and used the WC. It would be awkward to need to go during mass. When I descended, Mrs. Crichton had on her hat and coat. I put on my hat and scarf and we exited together without saying anything. Once on the pavement, I felt rather awkward. It had been years since I'd walked beside a woman other than Agnes, and I was used to offering my arm, and found myself starting to do so. But then Mrs. Crichton was about to take my arm. Sorry, I said hurriedly. It's an automatic reflex from when my wife and I walked to church together. I didn't mean to be forward. I almost took your arm for the same reasons. And it's been more than 5 years. We walked without engaging arms, each in our own thoughts. When we came to a pillar box, I posted the letter to Joseph. Have you maintained contact with your brother? Mrs. Crichton asked. Until the end of 1943, yes. Then somehow things went awry. I suspect some letters were lost, then Agnes died and the house wasn't there, so I've no idea if letters were returned, discarded or whatever. This is an attempt to re-establish communications. I hope it works out for you. Thank you. Part 13. The classroom used for the mass was a high-ceilinged room in what seemed to be a wartime corrugated iron structure rather like a barn. The exterior was painted green, likely to camouflage it in the trees that were around. It was on property right next door to St. Patrick's Church, with the main part of the school. Victorian or Edwardian brick. Further back from the road behind a yard. As we came in the door at the back of the room, we were greeted by a very tall man with grey hair, probably 10 years my senior, who said, "Good morning, Mrs. Crichton." "Good morning, Mr. Clitheroe. I'd like you to meet my lodger, Mr. Newman, who just got demobbed and is returning to Supermarine to work." I interjected, "We have actually met, I believe just once, when my daughter Margaret began here as a pupil." I saw a cloud pass over Clitheroe's face. "Yes, indeed. I am sorry for your loss, Mr. Newman. Your wife came to help out a few times when things got a little disorganized with the bombing. It was a great sadness to learn of their deaths. So much sadness, I'm afraid. Let us hope for a brighter future." Looking down at his hands for a moment, there were the nicotine-stained fingers I remembered. When he wasn't in front of students or here in church, I suspect he always had a cigarette in his hands. Possibly he wasn't as old as he looked. Other people were backing up behind us, so we moved along. Mrs. Crichton paused to check the announcements board. Some requests for help with setting up and taking down the altar each week. Meetings of the Catholic Women's Group. Invites to sing in the choir group. Appeals for various missionary and charity funds. "Are you comfortable if we sit together?" I whispered. "I don't want to cause gossip." "I think now you've been introduced, well reintroduced, to Mr. Clitheroe, your presence will be explained. It would likely cause more gossip if we sat apart." We found chairs halfway into the room. It did not have desks. "There aren't desks here. Is it really a classroom?" "It's used for the infants' classes, so they want to be able to clear space. Also used for assemblies, since it can accommodate everyone if they are standing. And easier for mass, but a bit hard on the knees. I forgot to pick up a kneeler. They are over there." Indeed, there was a box of stuffed leather rectangular cubes, each of which had a leather loop to make it easier to lift or carry. I went and got two from the box. They fitted tidily on end inside. A small bell rang, and the priest came in behind the altar boys. The mass commenced. In nomine Patris, et Filii, et Spiritus Sancti. As I said, I'm not a Catholic, but I went to Mass with Agnes and the form was familiar. I even understood enough of the Latin to appreciate the words. "Confitio Deo Omnipotenti." "Yes. I confess to Almighty God. But what do I confess? That I'm a living ghost. That I move, eat and sleep, but that I no longer have much will to do so. And neither, I fear, does the woman who is here beside me. A woman who I suspect has an even less solid connection to life than I. But I also confess I would like to feel alive again. Gloria in excelsis Deo, et in terra pax hominibus boni voluntatis. Well, maybe I could forego glory to God, but I genuinely welcomed. If it were really so. Peace on earth to men of goodwill. Did that mean no peace to the rest, to those of ill will? And there were surely plenty of those. Stalin. Some of the Nazi thugs no doubt slithering away under false names and false stories. Profiteers using the cover of chaos to kill, rob, rape, and despoil. We'd seen lots of that recently. But here, in this rather unimpressive room, a group of 50 to 60 people were trying to find peace, myself included. The ritual continued. We sat out the communion, and soon the last gospel was being recited. In principio erat verbum. In the beginning was the word. But what word was that? We said nothing as we filed out. I thought I might see the priest and could ask about Agnes and Margaret, but no doubt the undertaker would have better, or rather more precise, information, and the register office could provide death certificates. Part 14. Do you wish to go home right away? I asked Mrs. Crichton. I'm not sure what you mean. I'm thinking of taking a walk to Miller's Pond if you wish to join me. Oh. All right. It just never occurs to me, I'm afraid. We walked for a while in silence along the Portsmouth Road. When we came to the green area of Miller's Pond, we followed one of the paths. Will you be coming to Mass regularly, Mr. Newman? I think so. I hope I won't scandalize you, but I don't know if I'm actually a believer. I do believe in the sentiments of prayer, and the hope for peace and prosperity. But whether the doctrines and dogmas have any reality, I can't be confident. Given what we've both experienced in the last few years, I think that is understandable. Were you weeping this morning? I asked, probably too abruptly. You heard? I should learn not to make so much noise. Sometimes we need to weep, I said, knowing I had. There was a silence while we walked for about a minute, then Mrs. Crichton said, "In the night I heard you cry out. Did you know that you did? Once before, one of my assistants in the RAF mentioned I had. I'm sorry. I hope I didn't alarm you. You have probably seen too much that you should not have been burdened with." Mrs. Crichton was stating truth, unfortunately not asking me to explain. Yes. Well, perhaps we can both just accept each other's frailties and do our best to put them aside. Not forget, or ignore, but put in perspective, or else we won't be able to go on. I know I sometimes feel like a ghost. Not really here. Yes. That's not far from how I feel a lot of the time. We had come round to an exit of the park area, and I could see the Miller's Pond pub. Pity they are likely only open at 12, I said. Yes, I could use the lavatory. We walked back to Radstock Road, which wasn't far. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do for the rest of the day. I had Graham Greene's The Ministry of Fear to read. I could walk back to George Cummings and thank him. If he was amenable and not busy, I'd buy him a drink at the local. Perhaps see if any neighbors were around to say hello. Thus, after a quick visit to the small room, I set off again to Bitton. George and his wife were preparing for Sunday dinner, so I gave my thanks to George, explaining a little of what I'd found, and made a loose and indefinite promise that we'd meet up one evening for a drink. I suggested that when we did, his wife Mildred could join us too, but I suspect she would excuse herself. I went back to the crater and knocked on a couple of doors nearby. Three houses each side, and those immediately behind and in front were boarded up. The V1s had nearly a ton of high explosive and did a lot of damage. Only one person I knew answered, an elderly lady named Jameson. She insisted I come in for a minute, and I gave her a capsule account of what had happened to me. She said her house had lost all its windows, but the council had helped to get them replaced, though the glaziers only finished within the last 6 months, as glass was in short supply. "I'll leave you my current address, Mrs. Jameson. and Supermarine will have my office telephone if anyone wants to get in touch. It would be nice to hear from people I knew. So many are no longer here, either moved or dead. A terrible pity. Indeed it is, Mr. Newman. I left as soon as was politic, or she would insist on giving me tea or a sherry, and I knew how limited resources could be at this time. Walking up into Bitten Village, I found the Red Lion open and went in. The food options were few, but it turned out they did have a Cornish pasty. Since the filling was vegetable, the ingredients were a bit easier to come by, and the one I got was substantial and quite tasty. I had a half of cider to wash it down. After a visit to the rather antiquated urinal, I walked back to Radstock Road. Sundays, I feared, might be a difficult day for me. I'd need to find some activities to keep me occupied. Part 15. There you are, Mr. Newman. I wondered if you'd want something to eat. It was now 2:15. I got a Cornish pasty in the Red Lion in Bitten, I answered. I hope you didn't make anything special for me. No. Just wondered if you were going without. That's all. Even though I sometimes wonder if it is worthwhile, I've got in the habit of looking after myself. The other night, we talked of possible jobs that might need doing. Do you think it wrong to tackle some this afternoon? No. It's really the time when a working man can get to them, isn't it? Mostly I've some doorknobs and things that are loose. I'm not good with mechanical things, generally, even though my job at Thornycroft's involved parts for landing craft. Mrs. Crichton showed me the toolbox, which was under the stairs. I'll be doing a wash tomorrow. That's actually a job that does need doing. The washing line is loose, I think. I'm worried it'll pull away and the laundry'll be on the ground. Where should I put my things to be washed, Mrs. Crichton? We have a hamper. I'm afraid it's in my bedroom, but I think there's enough space in the bathroom. If you set it out, I'll put my things in it tonight, though my pajamas tomorrow morning. I should get a second pair. And a dressing gown. And should we turn on the tap for the bath? Yes. I'll have to show you where it is. And if I find anything more of Jeremy's things, we can see if they'll do for you. There's probably some old and possibly moth-eaten stuff, but maybe we can find something useful. Coming home to just, well, a hole in the ground must be very disturbing. I'm not sure I'm disturbed because there's nothing really there. But it is beastly inconvenient. For example, I just realized that you have a garden, and I used to do the digging for Agnes, and she tended the plants. It was nice working together. But now I've no Wellingtons or even work shoes. Oh. There's a pair under the stairs. And a boiler suit. I'm glad now I didn't get rid of them. I like the garden too, and we'll be able to grow some vegetables. Oh. But only if you want to. Mrs. Crichton, that's the first time you've shown a spark of enthusiasm for something. I'm very glad. It's a good sign. Now for today, I'll stick to jobs that aren't messy. And supper can be when it's convenient for you, as I've a book and perhaps we can listen to something on the light program this evening. Yes. That would be nice. Part 16. Monday, February 11th. I went into the office and around 9 o'clock telephoned the number of the undertaker and asked for the name on the card I'd found in the envelope. Alexander Beeston. How may I be of service? Mr. Beeston, my name is Newman. I've been in the RAF until last Thursday, and I was just given an envelope with my wife's rings and your card on Saturday afternoon. I wonder if you might have information on where my wife and daughter, Agnes and Margaret Newman,
are buried?
Ah yes, Mr. Newman. My sincere condolences. The V1 case. Most sad. Then I am correct that you took care of the burial. Indeed we did. I will have to check the records for the exact location. I can do so and call you back. Today I'm running errands. For example, I need to go to the register office to get death certificates because there are some bank accounts that need to be closed. And I want to find out if there is anything that needs to be done with the house, or rather the lot. Yes. I gather you were in Normandy serving when the bomb fell. It was most generous of your ARP friends to pay for the funerals. Oh. I had no idea and was about to ask if anything were owing. I will have to write a proper thank you. They also salvaged some photos and mementos for me. In fact, all in one tin box that in some ways gives me back some memories. Sorry, I'm being a bit soft. Not at all, Mr. Newman. In my business, we sometimes are more than usually aware that people keep their emotions too much inside. But since you are out and about today, if you come by our establishment, we're in Woolston at 35 Bridge Road. I'll make sure the location of the graves of your loved ones are in a note for you to pick up, and if I'm in, I'll ask that you say hello. That would be perfect. I know your building, as I work at Supermarine. I thought you did, but was afraid to say in case I had it wrong. I'm much obliged to you, Mr. Beeston. Until later. We rang off. I took a sheet of paper from a pad I had discovered in my desk and wrote personal telephone call log on the top and drew a line underneath. Then I noted the date, the time, the number, and the purpose of my call. I called Miss Shoreham. When she answered, I said, "Good morning, Miss Shoreham. I thought I'd telephone to let you know that I'm sorting out some administrative matters relating to my wife and our property, and I'll be making a couple of telephone calls. I've set up a log to record these and will be happy to reimburse the firm." I doubt that reimbursement will be necessary, but the log is a good idea to keep tongues from wagging. I suggest you submit the log to me at the end of each month. I'll file it in case there's a need. Thank you, Miss Shoreham. Before you ring off, can I ask if you are making progress with those matters you mentioned? Indeed. I was just talking to Mr. Beeston, the undertaker, and it appears my friends in the ARP paid for the funeral. And they rescued some photos, documents, and mementos and put them in a tin box for me. One of those was my daughter's post office savings book. That's one of the administrative details I have to sort out, unfortunately, but I would not have thought about it if they hadn't found it in the rubble. Unfortunately, no civilian clothing or furniture, but Mrs. Crichton had kept some of her husband's things, and they may find use, at least for gardening. Sorry. I'm rambling on. At least you are rambling on, which shows you are getting back into the swing of things. Good luck, Mr. Newman. Thank you. Goodbye. Part 17. I had no difficulty at the register office, except for finding the right part that dealt with certificates, etc. I had my RAF discharge and my identity card, and got the certificates for Agnes and Margaret without trouble. Then I had an appointment I'd made for noon with Duncan McKenzie at the bank I use. He was now 75, as he'd been brought back from retirement when his successor was called to work in some sort of economic warfare unit, then died in an air accident. Soon he'd be replaced. Come in, Mr. Newman. Welcome back, though it must be sad given what happened with your wife and daughter. Indeed. I need to talk to you about some administrative matters arising, as you may have guessed. Then let's get at it. If we've time to chat after, we will. First, I'll need to get a new checkbook. I've half a dozen I took with me. And I'll need a new bank book. I took the liberty of getting your file. You've £212.11.06 to your credit. Since I suspect anything else will use that account, let me call one of our staff to get that in progress so you have the book today as you leave. Mackenzie picked up his phone and a youngish woman came in. Some instructions were given and she left, saying if you ask for Miss Taylor at the inquiry's desk when you leave, I should have your bank book for you. Before I could thank her, she was gone. Mackenzie said, "What's next?" I think we need to close my wife's account. She was getting my pay until the V1. And before I left I put some money there. About £50. So she could keep the household going. Yes. That account has £67.03.04 halfpenny. I'll instruct that it be closed and credited to the account we just talked about with Miss Taylor. He wrote a couple of lines on a pad with his fountain pen. There's also the matter of my RAF pay since the V1. It will come to me in 3 installments as postal money orders or similar. Can they be deposited here, or do I need to get cash at the post office and bring it over? It's a total of around £450. We had no opportunity to spend money on the continent, and I don't smoke, so could buy minor luxuries with cigarettes. I even got a special allocation of 1,000 one time. That's quite a sum. Today I'm going to make a note that the monies will be coming in. Where are they being sent? I gave the Supermarine address, as I wasn't sure of where I'd be living. Oh. That's something else. My address is now 161 Radstock Road in Woolston. I'm lodging with a lady who lost her husband on the Hood and last year her daughter was run down by an American dispatch rider. Oh, that poor woman. It got in the papers. You have much in common. She told me we are an unmatched pair of leftovers. It's a description a little too accurate in some ways. Don't dwell too much on the past, Mr. Newman. You have life and some money, and you are young enough to build something new now Mr. Hitler isn't trying to kill us all. I could have taken Mackenzie's advice as gratuitous, but his tone was kindly. Did I dwell on the past? Not that I was aware of. Mostly I was numb. Numb from seeing destruction and death. Numb from not having a place to call home. Numb from, well, running on habit and following orders. I'd better focus on the here and now. So, will the RAF postal orders be able to be deposited here? I may have to check the particulars, but it seems extremely likely. And if this is going to be the pattern for the services, I think I will get my staff to arrange something with the post office so we handle the transaction rather than have a lot of people risking sums of money on the street. You surely won't be alone in your requirement. Lastly, though you may have no knowledge of what are the arrangements, I am about to try to see if there is any recoverable money from the land on which the house used to exist. Do you know if people are buying and selling? I'm afraid I've only heard what I term gossip, though with reconstruction, there has to be some flow of money. And what I was about to say earlier is that you have enough. Not a grand fortune, but enough. To merit consideration of how to invest it. I suggest we meet again in a month or so when some of the more tedious details have been regulated. That would be welcome, Mr. Mackenzie. Thank you. I'll be getting along. On my way out of the bank, I collected my new bank and checkbook. Agnes' money would be deposited either today or tomorrow. Next was the post office in the High Street. Like most buildings there, it had taken quite a few knocks. In fact, it was widely gossiped that only the Lion's Corner house survived intact on the street. Good morning. My name is Edward Newman. My wife and daughter were killed in the V1 attack in July of 1944. I've been in the RAF and unable to get home until now. My daughter had this post office savings account. Can you tell me what I need to do to close the account? The 30-ish man behind the wicket said, "We need to see proof of death. I see you have a death certificate there. And your proof of identity, and once those have been inspected, we give you the money. I'll see if Mr. Williams is available. He's the senior accounts officer. Perhaps you could take a seat over there. It shouldn't be too long." I fortunately had brought along Margaret's birth certificate, which named me as father. I had my discharge papers and identity card, and the savings book. Mr. Newman, a 60-ish man, asked at a doorway. "Perhaps you could come with me and we'll try to sort out your daughter's account." Williams took me to a small office where he sat one side and I the other of a modest desk. He had a form on his desk that he began to fill out. "Can I have the savings book, please?" I passed this across and he looked at it carefully, checking each page. My goodness, no entry since 1943. I was called up at the end of 43. As a war effort, I think Margaret stopped taking pocket money. Not that there were sweets or other things to buy. Yes. And still they are rationed. I recall the V1 bombing. Heard it myself, then read in the paper how your wife and daughter had perished, and you serving in Normandy. I only got back on Thursday. Demobbed that morning. That will serve well as your identity, I think, Williams said, nodding at the discharge papers. He looked over the document, noting Supermarine was my employer. "Ah. I see you're at Supermarine. Well, that makes things a bit easier, since you can be found there, I assume." Mr. Gooch or his secretary, Miss Shoreham, are personally aware of my role in the company, I said. "I'll still, unfortunately, need proof of death." I passed over the death certificate and got the discharge back. I took out the birth certificate just as Mr. Williams looked up and said, "Good. A birth certificate identifies your relationship to the deceased and that she was a minor, so we don't need to worry about a will. Now I need your current address." I gave this and it was written down. "Would you be offended if I called Supermarine? We've had some attempts at fraud. If I confirm by telephone, I can note it on the form and likely avoid auditors complaining." "Do you have the number?" I asked. "Our operators will. Yes, Williams here in savings accounts. Can you get me Miss Shoreham, secretary to Mr. Gooch at Supermarine, please?" There was a bit of a delay, then a very short conversation where it was clear Miss Shoreham gave Williams a succinct description of me and a statement that it was known to her that I was planning to close Margaret's account today. I think Williams may even have got a flea in his ear, and I had to suppress a smile. "I'll get you to sign and date the form here, Mr. Newman, and then I'll meet you at one of the cashiers, and we can give you the money right away." "I'm very grateful for the quick service, Mr. Williams. When someone has all the right paperwork, it is much easier. In fact, the only problem is that it represents sadness, and we can't repair that. A good day to you, Mr. Newman, and my best wishes for your future." Part 18. It was nearly 2 o'clock. I'd overlooked lunch. There was Lyons, so I went in and had the Welsh rabbit and a coffee. Just what the doctor ordered, and, I suppose, Margaret paid for, at least today. Rabbit was one of her favourite things. I forced back a tear, but still found pleasure in the cheesy snack. Then I went to the council office that dealt with houses and land. I wasn't sure what I'd find here. I didn't even know where our documents were. Well, the solicitor we'd used probably had copies. What was his name? Still, I could find out today what, if anything, had to be done. A young woman was behind the counter.
Good afternoon, sir.
How may I help you?
I came to inquire what I need to do, if anything, about a bombed-out house I owned.
Or at least used to own.
You weren't there when it was bombed, I take it.
I was in Normandy. It was late July 1944.
Oh dear.
The V1. Margaret Newman. She was a good friend of my youngest sister.
Yes. I'm Edward Newman, her father.
Give me the address and the date you purchased the house.
Fortunately, I remembered the date, June 28, 1931. We used to celebrate each year with a toast. And we'd paid off the mortgage in 1937. It occurred to me that there would be complications if we had still had a mortgage, since the payments would have ceased with Agnes' death and my essential imprisonment in the forces.
Let me check the files.
I had a wait of perhaps 10 minutes before she returned.
Well, the property transaction is registered in your name. There's an annotation that there was a compulsory demolition in late July 1944 to render the site safe, but nothing more. It would seem that you are the owner of the site, Mr. Newman, but there are a number of discussions going on right now about reconstruction. I probably shouldn't tell you this, but I suspect that the council will try to buy up the sites and redevelop that portion of the street, or at least consolidate the land to allow for new building. Dropping her voice to a whisper, she said if you want to get the most out of the site, it may pay to put in a request to rebuild. If the council is planning something, they'll possibly offer more that way. When they get round to trying for a block of sites, they can try compulsory purchase, claiming the land is rubbish at the moment.
Thank you. You've given me much to think about.
Part 19.
I walk back to the chain bridge then to Beeston's. Mr. Beeston was out at a funeral, but there was an envelope waiting for me. I opened it and read the brief information that Agnes and Margaret were together in a burial location the note identified in Hollybrook Cemetery. It was getting toward 4:30 and daylight was weakening. Back in my office, I checked for messages but there were none. I put my head round the door of Hall's office and asked if everything were going well, and he said he'd have some things to discuss in the morning, but there was nothing urgent or bothersome and that I might as well go home rather than start something now.
He was right. I'd done a lot today. Time to quit while I was winning.
Part 20.
Mr. Newman. You're early.
Yes, I had a very busy day and got a lot done. My number 2 suggested I not start something late in the day. And I must admit all the running around.
Well, walking around.
Was tiring.
I see you've been busy too.
I hope my laundry wasn't too demanding.
No.
I tend to think of people as heavy or light on clothing.
You're definitely light.
By that I mean you don't seem to get a lot of real dirt on things.
More just everyday sweat.
Of course collars and cuffs get pretty bad.
My Jeremy was a terror.
He liked Brill Cream, and his collars got every cinder and bit of fag smoke in Southampton.
Yours aren't nearly so bad.
I hope you don't like a lot of starch.
Never liked it.
In the forces we didn't bother.
Why get dolled up to get shot was how one of my drivers put it.
Sorry.
Maybe that was insensitive.
I suppose it could be, but I know you aren't insensitive.
Perhaps a bit the other way.
Sorry, letting my mouth run on.
Were you successful in your investigations?
Indeed, I was for the most part. I got my bank account sorted out and saw the bank manager.
My wife's account should be closed and deposited to my account tonight or tomorrow. I got death certificates for Agnes and Margaret. A bit sad, but it does help to close the book. And I used Margaret's to close her post office savings account. They did it right away. Phoned Supermarine to check I was genuine, but it isn't worth getting my nose out of joint because they paid it out right away and I don't have to go back and forth again. And Beeston's got me the location of the grave Agnes and Margaret are in, apparently together. Oh, that's sad. It means. Yes, I know. That they weren't very. Complete. Still, they are together in Hollybrook, and I found the ARP paid for the funeral. I shall have to write a thank you. Maybe get a nice card. That was generous of them. The American Army paid for Jenny's, and a bit of pain and suffering that by British standards is quite generous, but. But we'd rather have them back, wouldn't we? Yes. She wiped a tear from the corner of her eye. Would you like to go to the cemetery on Saturday or Sunday? It might be easier together. Yes. Yes, it would be easier. Especially with someone who knows how it hurts and you don't dare scream even though you want to. You don't have to go if it hurts so much. But it would hurt more not to go. Part 21. Within a couple of weeks, I fell into a routine. After 2 years of constant movement and change, this was comfortable. On the Thursday after I arrived, Mrs. Crichton said she intended to go to the pictures with a neighbor, Mrs. Brownlow, whose husband was in the RAF in India. She said I'd be welcome to accompany them. If I did, we'd eat quite early. If not, my supper would be kept warm on the boiler. I'd only seen a couple of films over the last 2 years, and those in not terribly favorable conditions to get the best experience of the films. Do you know what you want to see? We're thinking of Anchors Away. Neither of us like serious films with war subjects. That would suit me. What time should I be here for supper? Can you manage 6 o'clock so we can meet Enid outside at 7:30? The film starts at 7. I'll make sure I'm home in good time. Part 22. After the film, which we enjoyed, we went to a pub for a drink. I needed that, Mrs. Brownlow said. There's too much gloom and doom. And Fred wrote that the men in the RAF in India figure British ships are being used to take American GIs home rather than them. There are too many of us here in Britain who want to be an imperial power. The wireless and education mean the people in the empire are figuring out what they want for themselves. The Americans will pontificate about democracy and an end to colonialism, then set up their own form of imperialism based on large corporations. Chewing gum and Coca-Cola, if you will. Mr. Newman. I believe you're a cynic, Mrs. Brownlow challenged. Quite possibly, Mrs. Brownlow. But I hope that the government realizes that the men who volunteered or were conscripted for the war didn't sign on to be a police force to maintain commercial profits. I'm no communist, but I do believe in national self-determination within some limits of protecting the rights of the individual. You were lucky to get released so quickly, Mrs. Crichton said. I think Supermarine had some role in that. The DMOB score is based on age and months of service, plus some element of essential occupation. I'm not sure why my particular skills are regarded as necessary, since we're no longer at war, but my guess is the various bits of push and shove in the world mean airplanes are going to be needed. With the atomic bomb, it seems madness, Mrs. Brownlow said. I agree. Let's hope stupidity and nastiness don't get too much room to influence our lives. And I hope Mrs. Brownlow's husband gets home soon. Mrs. Brownlow said, I need to get home. Mrs. Kirby is looking after Jack, my 6-year-old. Part 23. My conversation with Mrs. Brownlow led me to pay closer attention to news items from India, though there weren't many. I wondered if reports were being censored or suppressed. After all we'd been through in the war, it seemed wrong to lose the peace. Our men should come home and India should become their own country. Of course, there were plenty of people who thought otherwise, our erstwhile leader Mr. Churchill right in the front row. That Sunday afternoon we went to Hollybrook Cemetery together. I'd bought a small bunch of flowers on Saturday and kept them in water overnight. Mrs. Crichton had an almost identical bunch. We gave each other a wan smile when we realized that we'd bought flowers at the same shop. We took 2 buses to get to Hollybrook and went to Jenny's grave, which had a simple flat stone with her name and dates. Then we figured out the plan of the cemetery and found where Agnes and Margaret were buried under a simple concrete marker with a number. "Will you get a gravestone?" Mrs. Crichton asked. "I'm not sure. I'll have to think about it. I'd like some sort of memorial, but I'm not sure that a gravestone is the right approach. Gravestones are more for the living than the dead, I feel."
"Yes. They serve us, not those we memorialize."
Despite what Mrs. Crichton had said, neither of us shed tears that afternoon. We walked back toward town and found a small cafe where we had a cup of tea and an indifferent bun. We said little, but there was no awkward silence. Mrs. Crichton had made some woolton pie, which we heated up in the oven and had with some baked beans. I took my bath and put on the somewhat dilapidated dressing gown Mrs. Crichton had found in an old suitcase. She'd had to boil it to kill off the moths and darn some holes. Still, it gave warmth and provided for modesty. She'd also found an old duffel coat that somehow had been packed with lavender and was in quite reasonable shape except for a bad stain on the pocket. Jeremy started to use a fountain pen and forgot it was in the pocket when he sat down on the bus, Mrs. Crichton explained. She suggested it be used for being outside for working. However, I asked whether buying some cloth for bigger pockets, or really fake ones, would cover up the stain.
"What a clever idea. It would make his usable as a regular coat. I'll do it.
Only if you let me pay you a reasonable amount for it," I cautioned. Part 24. Whether it was the visit to the cemetery I can't say, but that night I woke from a terrible dream. Mostly it was the same dream. Well, nightmare. That I often had. Tenier Square in Antwerp. November 27, 1944. A cold day. I was trailing a British motor convoy and was a couple of hundred yards away or more when a V2 came down right on the square above the MP who was directing traffic. Apparently it exploded in the tram lines, as we didn't find a crater, but it burst a water main and flooded the square. 126 killed, about a fifth of them military, but many civilians given that Teniers was possibly the busiest intersection in the area. Mostly the Germans couldn't hit a barn door from 10 feet with their V weapons, and their destruction was random. This time it was a bullseye. The water bubbled up from the water main and floated the corpses, or rather the pieces thereof. And petrol from the vehicles floated too, and caught fire. A terrible and ghastly mess. I and many others rushed to help as best we could. The rocket hit just after noon and I was ordered away at 5 o'clock by an MP who told me I was too exhausted to be of more use. But tonight, my horror was amplified by body parts that belonged to Agnes and Margaret. I must have made a lot of noise, because I awoke to Mrs. Crichton saying, "Wake up, Mr. Newman. Wake up. You're having a bad dream." As I recognized what she was saying, I realized where I was.
"Oh. Mrs. Crichton.
I'm so sorry. My regular nightmare.
Why don't you tell me about it? She said very quietly.
You'll get cold.
She was wearing a dressing gown, but our breath was fogging.
I could come under the covers.
I'm wearing my dressing gown over a nightdress. Whatever the propriety of the situation, I was still confused by the dream and let her slip in beside me. The space was tight, and she had to lie on her side and I was against the wall. Without thinking, I extended my arm as she came in the bed. I could feel she was wearing bed socks.
A good idea.
I should get some.
Tell me about your dream, she repeated, calmly rather than as a command.
I related what I've described.
There was silence for some seconds.
I can see why you have the nightmare. And it was one of those terror weapons too that killed your family. We think of them as being aimed at England, but the Germans used them against Belgium too.
Yes. 2 weeks later, and only a short distance away on the same street, they hit the Rex cinema. 561 killed, many of them Allied servicemen. Two were members of my unit and one I counted as a friend. The authorities forbade big groupings after that.
You don't have nightmares about that?
I don't think so. Or at least none I can remember. And I wasn't a witness to it, though a few days afterwards I saw the ruin.
And you probably saw other horrors.
Yes. In Normandy, as we broke out, our tactical air force planes, mostly Typhoons with rockets, nailed a German column. They rocketed it, then passed over it with their cannons firing. A lot of dead. My transport people had to pass by after the engineers had simply bulldozed everything. Vehicles, bodies, weapons. Through the hedgerow so we could use the road to move up supplies. And at the end of the war, I took supplies into The Hague and saw a place called Biswidenhout. We and the Americans tried to get the V-2 launching sites that were in what is called the Haagse BOS. The Hague Woods. Which is, or was, a big park. But there was cloud and they missed by about a mile and dropped 67 tons of explosive on this suburb. And in the chaos the Germans tried to launch rockets so they wouldn't be destroyed on the ground, but a couple fell back on the same area. 511 killed, but more to the point, 20,000 homeless. Hardly anything left. Make Southampton look like it got a few scratches. But again, I wasn't in the midst of it like Antwerp.
Well, you've told me now. Perhaps that will dilute the horror a little and let you get some peace.
Thank you for listening. We were quiet for a while. Somehow we must have fallen asleep, because my alarm clock was ringing. Mrs. Crichton almost fell out of bed and I sat up. My arm had gone to sleep and I had to use the other to turn of the bell.
I'd better get breakfast on, she said.
Part 25. We were both very quiet at breakfast.
Was it embarrassment? Shame?
I don't think so. Anyway, we had our porridge and I went to work. There were some new arrangements to set up for instruments that were needed for the jet engine tests we'd need to make, so plenty of details to sort out. Hall and I worked well together. Nothing yet on the horizon to give him a promotion, but we did discuss advertisements or news items that might be relevant, and I was contributing about half of these to the conversation. I'd meant what I'd said about helping his advancement.
Or mine.
At supper, we were still rather quiet. Finally, when we were washing up the dishes, I drifted into the habit of drying them. Mrs. Crichton said I didn't mean to stay for the rest of the night.
No. No. I realize that. But I think both of us feel awkward.
Yes. Very awkward. But we weren't intending to be immoral. We didn't do anything that was impure. I recognized the language of the catechism. I felt I had to try to reduce Mrs. Crichton's anxiety. Mrs. Crichton, we are both people who have had very unpleasant experiences in the last few years. Somehow we are trying to cope. When I came here, I was at a very low point. I have started to find I want to make something of my life, and that was not the case before the last couple of weeks. The situation of the landlady and the lodger is a cliché that is exploited by comedians of bad taste. I know both of us wish to stay far from such a situation. But I will say that your companionship has been extremely helpful to me, and I hope I am able to be a decent and helpful person in your life. Yes. I found things a little brighter since you came. There was another silence, but it wasn't awkward, just thoughtful. I wonder if I should see a doctor about my nightmares. Do they come every night? No. Probably about once a week. But last night was different with Agnes and Margaret. Perhaps the visit to the cemetery triggered something. Possibly. Why don't we see how you get on for a week or so? Doctors sometimes get all in a hurry to do something, when time is the best medicine. Or rather, time and a peaceful life. Mrs. Crichton, are you talking about me or you? I smiled. Perhaps both of us. Again there was a silence. I said, you know, last night was the only time I've slept. And I mean slept. With a woman other than Agnes. And I've no physical experience of a woman other than her. I had one girlfriend before Agnes. A bit of what the ranks used to call slap and tickle, but really adolescent fumbling and definitely nothing approaching intercourse. When we went into Holland there was a woman. She couldn't have been more than 24 or 25 and she spoke pretty good English. In fact knew some words that related to sex I'd never heard before. She offered me pretty well any fantasy I wanted. Turned out the reason was she had two kids aged 2 and 3. The father was one of the reprisal executions for some resistance operation. If you are telling me, I doubt you took up her offer. Mrs. Crichton was getting to know me. You're right. But I actually committed a crime and stole some supplies from our lorries for her. Well, mainly for her kiddies. The RAF can court-martial me if they want. I'll be happy to plead guilty, especially if those children are all right. Mr. Newman, I feel rather strange calling you Mr. Newman after the stories we've shared. Can I use your first name? Yes. Call me Ted. My friends do. And I've no idea of your name. Maud. Used to be Maud Smith. Very plain. Now Maud Crichton. I'd have been married 18 years this Easter. Well, April 14th. The Saturday after in 1928. Easter's going to be late this year. April 21st. Part 26. Tuesday night, there was a knock on the door. It was Ralph Dixon, one of the ARP men I'd volunteered with. I'd found a card and written a sincere thank you to the men. I sent it via George, since I was pretty sure the office had been closed. There was talk of disbanding the entire service, but already most volunteers had been released. Ted, I wanted to come round to say hello and tell you about your bicycle. Better come in. I brought Ralph in and introduced him to Mrs. Crichton, who was sitting in one of the wing chairs. Well, Ted. When we cleaned up your place, the back shed was flattened. I found your bike and a girl's one under the roof planks pretty banged up. I'd got a bunch of similar wrecks from other places with permission of the owners, but couldn't contact you and didn't want to waste the parts. The bike I'm on tonight has bits of yours, and I didn't want anyone to get the wrong idea.
I'm glad you used it. Rather than have it dumped or used by someone I don't know.
As a bit of payback, maybe you want to come by my allotment sometime. Leave a note at my house. I'll give you the address, and you can let me know when you can come. We'll see if we can find enough to make you a bike.
That'd be helpful.
We had a cup of tea and Ralph left. I'd have to figure out where to put a bicycle here if I got one. Never had a car, though I did learn to drive in the late 30s. We were starting to look for a car when war loomed, and we'd postponed our search.
Part 27. There was no repeat of Maud having to wake me from a nightmare. The bad dreams didn't exactly stop, but they changed. Sometimes I'd be by the Rec Cinema as a spectator to the rocket hitting it. Other times I was riding one down onto Tenier's Square. Horrifying, but somehow when I was in the dream I was a detached observer. And I'd wake up before being confronted by the things that upset me most. In fact, I started to have a realization that I was in a dream and there was a sort of wake-up switch I could flip if I felt I wanted to. Moreover, I didn't hear Maud weeping. Had she stopped, or was she crying when I wasn't about? In the meantime, we lived simply. We didn't give anything up for Lent. Rationing had achieved greater strictures than were necessary for spiritual growth. We went to the pictures with Enid Brownlow again later that week. So I know where I'm going with Wendy Hillier. The crux of the story is the choice of marriage for security over marriage for love. Being cinema, the girl falls in love, then finds the object of her affection is rich.
What did you think of the film? I asked Maud as we walked home.
Enid had taken a bus right away to get her son from the lady minding him, while Maud and I had a drink and a packet of crisps before making our way back to Radstock Road.
I liked it. It shouldn't be taken seriously, though.
What do you mean by serious?
The cinema, and novels, and magazine stories for that matter, make it seem like there's this magic called love that turns everything right. I thought I had that with Jeremy when we got married, but I soon realized that it doesn't put bread on the table, even if the emotion is real and the people are honest and moral. The longer-term loving can't do much about money either, but it is less fragile.
But gives more pain when we lose someone, I think.
That too.
Ted, do you think you're still in love with Agnes?
I don't know. I still miss her. I mentioned the Dutch woman. But you know, I've not had the kind of physical urges for a woman since I learned Agnes had died. Only in the last little while have I even started to notice myself looking at a woman and registering that she is attractive. I'm not sure if that's a good sign or a nuisance.
Probably a good sign as long as you don't find yourself chasing around after them.
What about you, Maud? Do you think you'll want to try again?
The idea interests me rather than attracts me. I think the war and Jenny kept me more or less on ice. Then Jenny's death nearly finished me. I think for the last year I've just run on automatic pilot.
Yes, that rather describes the feeling.
Part 28. On Saturday the 2nd of March I went out to Ralph Dixon's allotment. He had moved an Anderson shelter there and made a shed of it, with a sort of awning in front to keep the rain off a bricked area. The shed was full of bicycle bits.
Let's see if we can find enough for a bike for you, Ralph said. Won't look like much, of course.
If it gives me transport, I don't care what it looks like.
We set to looking for parts that would fit together. It turned out the only workable combination was a women's pattern frame, but it was large enough for me. The wheels were slightly different in style, and we had to fit unmatched brakes to them.
Single speed.
There was a basket for the front, but no carrier at the back. There were mudguards in two very different colors and styles. It took us about 2 hours to get it together, and it would likely need an hour more of adjustment, plus we needed to ensure the inner tubes wouldn't simply deflate in a minute or two. We decided to leave things until the next Saturday, and I'd take 3 inner tubes and try to check them back at Radstock Road. Ralph gave me a puncture repair kit and a tire pump. He implied I'd need them. I spent the better part of the Sunday afternoon with a basin of water and the pump and repair kit, but ended up with 3 inner tubes that I thought would hold air. 2 for the bicycle and 1 spare. I'd need to buy another repair kit and probably a new pump. Part 29. Maud thought it curious and somewhat comic that I used a female pattern bicycle. That is, until I pointed out that we could share this vehicle since we were not terribly different in height. I am not a large man in either height or weight, making possible this sharing of the bicycle. I spent several shopping sessions looking for a padlock, chain, pump, carrier, spanner, spoke adjuster, and puncture kit, but by Palm Sunday we had a bicycle. "We'll have to look for another so we can cycle together," I said to Maud one evening.
"Oh. All right. How shall we go about that?"
"Given that we have a female pattern, we can look for either a male or female one. The Echo may have advertisements, but we can also look in shops, though I'll have to see if we need points.